It's time now for Money Matters with the Lewis family. Doug, Linda, and Deborah, owners of Lewis Financial Management, a Raleigh-based family-owned financial planning firm providing financial advice since 1983. Doug and Deborah are certified financial planners, CFPs, who can answer any of your questions about investments, retirement planning, and estate planning. Call Doug, Linda, and Deborah at their office, 919-872-7000, with your financial planning questions. That's 919-872-7000. Now, here are Doug, Linda, and Deborah.
Investments offered through SFA Inc. Investment advice through Lewis Financial Management. SFA Inc. and Lewis Financial Management are not related entities. And we are the Lewis family, ready to answer your questions tonight.
This is Linda Lewis, and thank you for joining us on Money Matters on News Radio 680 WPTF.
And I'm Doug Lewis, Certified Financial Planner.
And I'm Deborah Lewis, Certified Financial Planner. And we're here to answer your questions for the next hour.
This is Doug Lewis, Certified Financial Planner. How can I help you?
Yeah, I'm interested in charitable remainder trust. We're a two-career couple with no children.
Two-career couple. How old are you?
49 and 46.
49 and 46. Your income and hers?
150.
100,000 and 50,000. No children.
Right.
Okay. Now let me ask you a couple of devil's advocate questions. For example,
sure.
What is it that attracts you, and why do you want a charitable trust? Usually, I'm the one recommending them.
I would like to leave a significant amount of money to a university in the name of my father.
All right. Outstanding. Now, the charitable remainder trust is, in my opinion, and I think Linda would agree with me, the most powerful financial planning tool available today. It can do about four things at once. You have to really walk carefully through the arrangement to make it work right. But the first thing you can do, and the only thing you ought to be careful of, is learn who not to do it with. You want to not make the trustee the charity. You want to be the trustee yourself. So we want to set up a charitable remainder trust. Are you thinking of transferring real estate or cash or securities? What were you thinking of putting into this trust?
A combination of things. A real estate partnership.
Can't do a real estate partnership. What else?
Cash.
You can do cash.
Securities.
You can do securities. And you can do real estate. You can do real estate if there's no mortgage on it.
Okay, life insurance.
I can't do life insurance. There are special rules on doing on giving life insurance to the charitable trust. That's
okay.
A tricky one. About how much are you thinking of putting into this charitable trust?
About a half. All right.
Here's what you can do. Number one, and you want to work with a financial planner who is experienced in the area of charitable trust. But number one, we want to establish a charitable remainder unit trust, and I would recommend a NIMCRUT. They come in different flavors, if you will. There is the charitable trust called the straight charitable trust. Then there is the net income charitable trust. And then there's the net income with a payout provision or an IOU account. And that's the makeup account, the M of NIMCRUT. So I would use a NIMCRUT. We establish this charitable remainder trust. We make it a NIMCRUT. And we identify you as the trustee. So you're going to transfer from your own name this $500,000 of assets into your name as trustee of this charitable trust. We're going to then identify you and your wife as the income beneficiaries for the remainder of your lives. You now then will be paying yourself income for the rest of your lives and you will control all of the investments in this NIMCRUT. The key to establishing it is the payout rate. Since you're young and your income is high, and I presume your expenses are not $150,000.
No, not even close.
All right. If that's the case, then we want to set the payout rate as low as permissible by law. And the reason is the amount that grows inside this charitable trust will grow into the millions at your age. Not only is it going to give you a tax deduction on your income taxes, then you're building up what's called an IOU account, the makeup account inside this charitable trust, so that let's say 10 years from now, when you're 59, you can start to pull out as much as $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 for yourself and for your wife for retirement income needs as you see fit according to your makeup account. The key is the trustee. The other thing is, I would advise you, do not make your charitable beneficiary irrevocable. You can change the beneficiary as many times as you want during your lifetime.
Does that kind of help, David?
Yeah, man, it helps a lot, Ms. Boston.
If you would like some further information on this, you can call us at the office in Raleigh. Okay. And that number is 919-872-7000. That's USA 7000.
Okay.
And we'll be happy to send you some information.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for calling.
I really like getting a call like that. You know, not many people even know about the charitable trust. So it's usually we who are advising to use one. But like, I forget the poet, Deborah, do you remember who the poet was that said, a little knowledge is a dangerous thing, drink deep or taste not of the Pierian spring?
I don't know, but it sounds like Mark Twain, but...
No. I think it was a British...
Oh, well, anyway, I'll have to look it up later.
All right, my point is, a little knowledge is dangerous. Now, many people know enough about charitable trust, but not enough to realize that they are irrevocable. Which means once you've set it up, you can't change it, and it's going to last for maybe 20 or 30 years.
Right.
There is a standardized trust document or format given to us by the Internal Revenue Code. It's right there in the code. You can actually just download it if you want, but that's not the best kind of trust document.
Right.
Because, all right, here's a little quiz question. Is a trust a human or a non-human?
Non-human.
Very good, Deborah. All right. Linda, if a trust is a non-human, then how do I give something to a non-human?
Well, you have to set up a document.
I can't give it to a document, can I?
Well, you give it to an entity that would now have a tax ID number, which would be similar to being
entity a can't sign anything. How does an entity sign?
Oh, so I see where you're going. Okay, so this non-human needs a human.
That's exactly the point.
Okay.
The non-human, which is a trust, needs a human to sign the papers.
Right.
What's that human called?
A donor.
Trustee.
Or a trustee.
The trustee is the crucial person here.
Individual.
Yeah, the trustee is the one that signs the trust.
Well, it does everything.
The
really.
Trustee controls
the trustee follow controls the instructions
it.
Of the document that Linda was just talking about.
That's exactly right, Deborah.
So we
okay,
create, yeah.
So now we come to the matter of trustee. The trustee is the one who runs this thing for the rest of your life. So let's think about this.
Okay.
David wanted to give something away. All right. $500,000 of real estate.
So those are the instructions, right?
So who does he give it to?
He's giving it to the university, but...
Who's he giving it to today?
He gives it to this trust.
Well, trust is a non-human.
That's right.
So who signs that I received it?
The trustee.
The trustee.
Of the trust.
All right. The trustee becomes the crucial player. There has to be a trustee, but you have to be very careful
who
do you select as trustee.
If you want to call us during the week to set up an appointment for yourself, give me a call at 919-872-7000, and we will get started. We'll make a list of the questions that are on your mind.
Now, who's the most trusted person that I can give something to right now?
Myself.
If I could somehow be the trustee and give it to myself, then I'm pretty sure that I'm not going to be cheating myself.
Or that I'm going to follow all my own desires and wishes and everything's going to go the way I want it to be done.
Very good, Deborah. To follow all of those wishes that I wrote when I, as the donor, set up this trust. Does the IRS tell us who can be the trustee?
No.
There is nothing that the IRS says. It just has to have a trustee.
Trustee, that's right.
So there is no provision that says you can't be your own trustee.
Which is very powerful.
Which is very powerful. Unfortunately, 90% of the charitable trust documents that I have seen after they've been done and brought to me are not self-trusteed and it cannot be changed. They're usually the trustee is going to be the charity. Or the trustee is going to be a bank or the trustee.
A bank or a...
Right, right. So first thing is we need to go ahead and said we have to go ahead and get that trustee in place. First thing in your trust document. All right.
Now, let's back up here just a moment because we are having a discussion for our listeners.
By the way, I just remembered who said a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. It was Alexander Pope.
Good job. All right.
All right, go ahead.
Yeah, somebody must have Googled that. Here we are talking about charitable trusts.
Right.
And setting up a 664 trust where someone gives away an appreciated asset like stock or real estate.
Or a business.
Or a business. And do what, Doug?
Well, the question backs up to why do I want to do it? Why do I want to give it away? And it's very simple. I want to give away that stock or that business or that real estate because if I sell it, I'm going to pay a lot of taxes. But if I could set up a trust and give it to a trust and let the trust sell it, it's no tax, which means all of a sudden there's a whole bunch more money. Now the human that runs that trust is the crucial player. So that's got to be myself. The rules of the trust then say, this trust, run by this trustee, will take the money and invest it and pay an income from the trust to the income beneficiary.
And, you know, you're bringing in two new players. So right. Here we are talking about trusts and the real usefulness is, well, as part of education tonight, let's talk about the people who are involved in setting up a trust. So we've named the person who gave the thing away. That's the donor or the grantor. And then we've named the person who's going to run this thing that is a non-person entity, and that's the trustee. And then you just mentioned a beneficiary. Who's going to benefit from it?
Right. You're exactly right, Deborah. We have the donor. That's the person that owns everything and is trying to set this trust up.
Okay.
Then we have the trustee.
He's going to follow the instructions of the document.
And written by the donor.
Written by the donor.
And the most important thing now is the document says there's got to be an income beneficiary that the trustee pays. And who should that be?
That should be me.
That should be me also.
Yeah.
So me wants a giveaway to me to tell me to turn around and pay
me.
Give
me money.
There you go.
All right. Sounds like a good deal so far.
Sounds like a great deal. Let's make it even better.
Okay.
All right.
If you'd like further information, call us at 919-872-7000 or go to our website, DougAndLinda.com. That's DougAndLinda.com.
How about if I go ahead and say, I want to get a tax deduction this year for giving to this me? Can I get that?
You can.
I can if there's one condition in the document.
And what is that?
That it goes to a charity in the end.
That at the end, after I die, whatever is left in this thing, and that's the remainder word of remainder trust, whatever is left in this thing after I die goes to a charity. Okay, so now we've gotten it pretty powerful. I get a tax deduction this year for doing it.
Does that tax deduction get repeatable, or is it just in the first year?
Actually, there's a yes and a yes to your answer, to your question. Yes, it's all used the first year if you can use it.
Okay.
But if it's such a big tax deduction,
right.
Then you get to carry it over for 5 more years after the gift, which means you can spread it over 6 years,
right.
Which makes it very powerful.
Wow. So let's use some numbers,
okay,
to make this a little bit more understandable because it's great to have the education, but for all of our listeners, let's use some numbers.
Go ahead.
So let's say someone has a farm that's worth about $1 million.
Okay.
Or more.
All right.
Okay. Now.
Or a business.
Maybe this family inherited the farm from their grandparents.
Okay.
And they are business people. So.
If they sell
it.
They want to sell it. And if they sell it, they can end up having to pay, who knows, maybe $300,000 or $400,000 in North Carolina and federal taxes, capital gain tax, all kinds of things. Because whatever, the accountant told them it's going to cost you between $300,000 and $400,000 in taxes if you sell it. But instead, you could set up this charitable trust and name yourself as the trustee.
And transfer the asset out of your estate.
Well, you just give it from yourself to where you owned it, to this trust, which the trust owns it. And now the trustee, which is also you, has instructions. But by giving it to this trust, you're going to get a tax deduction of maybe $100,000 on your tax return. And as I just told Deborah, if you can't use the whole $100,000 because you're always limited by how much charitable deduction you can use according to your adjusted gross income, you can spread the rest of that $100,000 over 5 more years.
Go ahead, get started. Give us a call during the week at Lewis Financial Management. Make an appointment to sit down face-to-face and discuss your situation. The number at our office during the week is 919-872-7000. That's 919-872-7000.
Okay, but now there's one condition here. The condition is that a charity has to receive it at the end. I told you at the beginning that a trust is, this kind of trust is irrevocable, can never be changed. So how about the charity?
Can the charity be changed? Is that what you're asking?
That is the question. Most people think the charity can never be changed.
No, the charity can be changed.
That's correct. If the document
says so.
Says so.
It gives it that ability or that
flexibility.
No, there's actually a word like when you give a trust a power, what is it in the document itself? You know, we can change
right.
it.
Okay. All right. Let's leave Linda's.
Well, I remember because
we had
a charitable trust and
you did
we were able to change the beneficiaries. I mean, you can always.
That's the one you did for your mother many, many, many years ago, right? And she had a charity she wanted, right? Did she ever change it?
Yes, we did.
We did
change the charity.
That's right.
So for our listeners, if you set up a charitable trust and you have designated a charity, you can always add on other charities if you want to add to the list, and you can subtract.
Only if the trust document gives that permission.
Exactly.
So now we have to have that provision built in there. So it becomes the most powerful of all financial planning tools to be able to go ahead and create something that benefits you, avoids all the taxes if you do it right.
You're listening to Money Matters with the Lewises on News Radio 680 WPTF. There are some other considerations regarding taxes. And what are the tax implications of converting a person's 401k?
Well, when you say converting it to what? To a Roth? You mean Roth conversions?
To a Roth IRA.
That's exactly right, Linda. The subject of Roth conversions is also going to get a lot of attention this year. It got a lot of attention last year. There was a writer who wrote into the News and Observer, and the question written by the writer sort of went like this. I'm thinking about converting my 401k to a Roth IRA this year. I retired late last year at age 65. I have about $750,000 in my 401k. I'll receive a 5-year payout from my company, about $40,000 a year, when I retire. And this, plus Social Security, should be adequate to meet my expenses until I'm 70 years old. So I don't need to tap into the Roth for at least 5 years. I think I have enough cash on hand to cover the taxes owed on the conversion. I figured a conversion is going to help lower my taxes since my Roth will not have to make any required minimum distribution when I hit 70 and a half. I'm divorced. I want my daughter to inherit my IRA. What do you think? So that was the question that was written in. And I think it's really interesting because we get that question again and again and again. But we have to think about this. What is the Roth conversion all about, Deborah?
Well, it would be taking something that hasn't been taxed. Income that your employer allowed you to put aside.
Right.
And then converting it to an account to where you would pay the taxes on it.
Right. And then what's the benefit of doing that? That's called a Roth.
Right. So the benefit here would be to have your now after-tax dollars be able to grow and continue to grow in a tax-deferred environment.
Because the Roth IRA allows you to take everything out later on tax-free.
That's right.
As long as you meet a couple conditions.
You have to pay the taxes up front, right? When you do the conversion?
That's right. But the benefit is, once you've got it set up, if you wait 5 years, everything can come out tax-free.
That's right. It gives you the ability to use now after-tax dollars and let them grow in a tax-deferred environment.
Okay, and so that's what this lady wrote into the News and Observer about, and that's exactly what we get so often. The big issue here is, how much is it going to cost to convert?
Yeah, that...
Yeah, now on a $750,000 401k
plan, retirement plan,
it's probably going to cost federal taxes of over $250,000. Then you got to add in North Carolina taxes. So the big question is, well, does it make sense for me to pay $250,000 or more right now so that it will be able to not have any taxes later on when it comes out? And that's very complicated. Big issue is, do I want to take $250,000 and give it to the IRS right now?
Right. Right now, you're in a situation where you have something that hasn't been taxed and it can remain so indefinitely.
Exactly.
Especially if you don't need to live on it until you age 70. And I shouldn't say indefinitely, but just until age 70. So the real question is, why would you want to induce or incur this tax?
And many, many people are still asking this question, should I do it? Because they're being promoted very strongly. I think what's needed is a professional who can use a database such as we at Lewis Financial Management. We create a database to analyze this, run the tax projection before and afterwards, and see, does it make sense? Because you can't just answer that question very simply.
Right.
You need a financial or tax advisor who can analyze your personal situation and help determine if the conversion makes current financial sense.
You're listening to Money Matters with Doug, Linda, and Deborah Lewis. Call 919-872-7000 or visit our website, dougandlinda.com.
So, what's the negative to it? The negative, of course, is that $250,000 that you gave in taxes, you can't invest it.
Right. So if you're interested in this, you definitely have to come to the end of it with an answer of analysis.
That's right. So, you know, if you have that amount of cash lying on hand, you can invest this money rather than use it to pay taxes. In the lady's case who wrote the question, her daughter could inherit the investments that $250,000 got invested in. And then when she died, she'd even get it tax-free as a step-up in basis.
Right.
So now we get really complicated here. All right. For example, you invest $250,000. It grows, let's say it's 6% after taxes. You die in 20 years.
Okay.
Well, what's it going to be worth then? Over $800,000 that the daughter would then be able to receive, inherit, and sell tax-free because of... So, whoa, all of that got avoided if you convert because that money never was available.
Right.
All right. Then you have the question of, well, what about the 401k? What could be done there? Well, she could roll that over to an IRA and let's say get that invested at 7% over the years. And then what might happen, even if she started taking out her retirement, you know, her required minimum distribution year by year, if she died at age 85, then the daughter might go ahead and still get, who knows, maybe
1.7 million,
another 1.7
plus the 800.
So you might end up with numbers like 2.5 million
versus
a fortune. Yes.
It gets really complicated because there are a lot of things to consider. You got to consider, what about future Medicare premiums? What about future changes in the tax law?
And what about if this person decides they want to get married in the future?
That's right, Lindsay.
This person is only, 65? Yeah. Around 65. And so, you know, I met someone that got married at 70.
I think the bottom line here on the Roth IRAs, just like the charitable trust, Linda, the bottom line is you need to consult with a professional such as we at Lewis Financial Management, who will be able to build a database, run the analysis, and then see which way it works out better for you. You can't just answer the question because a column in the newspaper or a column online said, do Roth IRA conversions.
You're listening to Money Matters with the Lewises on News Radio 680 WPTF. If you have a 401k question, and maybe you're wondering how much you contribute, and are you in the right investments within your 401k?
Or a Roth conversion.
Or should you do a Roth conversion? And you can call us in Raleigh at our office at Lewis Financial Management at 919-872-7000. Well, Doug, there was another interesting article that I believe I saw in the Morningstar Investor. It had to do with someone had a huge portfolio and they wanted to cut it down to size. Kind of interesting here.
Hang on. I think I can get a hold of that article, Linda, because Morningstar is a very reputable source of analysis, third-party analysis of different mutual funds. And the writer in that particular issue, now that issue, I don't know if the public gets that issue very much. It's called
probably not.
Morningstar Fund Investor. But they offered a service which said, if you want us to look at your investment portfolio, send us the information and we will go make recommendations. And so what you're talking about here, I've got it here right in front of me now. The article was cutting a huge portfolio down to size. That was the article, right, Lynn?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, Deborah, I don't know if you had a chance to look at that or if you saw it, but basically the writer here says, I'm 56 years old, I'm single, and I have $1 million saved. But I fear it's nowhere near enough, and I wish I could work forever, but know that at my age, layoffs come quickly and out of nowhere.
So this could be anyone. This is.
It could be. Her name was Catherine, but it could be anybody. Her email requested a portfolio makeover from Morningstar. She's a media professional. She has money in several different pools, including a 401k, a Roth IRA. She has a Roth, multiple taxable brokerage accounts, including one managed by her financial advisor. And her dilemma, she says, is my money is all over the place. Okay, so when he looked at this, he approached it as a money manager.
She.
No, he.
Oh.
Was it a he or she
no,
who wrote
it was
the article?
A she.
Was it a she? Okay. All right. Okay, so she writes there that she says, this lady, Catherine, is luckier than most because she's got a pension coming during retirement that's going to give her $25,000 a year and Social Security. That's going to give her about another $36,000 a year. Her main goal is to make sure the total asset allocation of all of her accounts is on the right track. She knows that at this life stage, it's wise to start taking risk off the table. Well, you know, as I was reading this, Linda, Deborah, I started looking at this and realized we're missing a lot of information here. We're missing, well, what kind of information would you want, Deborah, if we were going to meet with her and give her our opinion?
Okay. Well, I guess I'm missing living expenses.
That's right.
How much does it cost for her to take care of herself right now? And then I guess I'm also missing living expenses that would be desired living expenses. What does she want to spend after she retires?
That's another thing we're missing. And we're also missing, what about anything other than her mutual funds? What other assets are we missing? We don't have a financial statement.
Does she own any real estate?
Does she own any real estate?
Does she have a business?
Does she have a business?
Does she have some rentals, etc.?
And of course, we don't know. What about her liabilities? Does she have a mortgage on her home? So all of this other information is financial planning information, which we will insist on having before we will give any advice. But this is a money manager's approach, and it's not one that we would use at all. But it's very interesting the way he approached it, or she approached it, excuse me. The Morningstar writer approached him. The Morningstar writer says that Catherine liked to work. She wants to work up until she's 65 or 67, but she's bracing herself for the possibility, worst case, she is going to lose her job within the next 2 years. And so she then looks at the portfolio with a before and an after. The before says, Catherine's portfolio is sprawling more than most portfolios, has 50 different funds. That's a big portfolio when you consider she's invested exclusively in mutual funds rather than 50 individual stocks.
If you have a question and would like to ask it either after hours or have me call you back after the show, feel free to call the office, 919-872-7000. That's 919-872-7000.
And then the analyst says, well, he or she sees 45% equity weighting, 27% in cash, 27% in bonds. The portfolio has a very big emphasis on inexpensive ETFs. And then comes the after portfolio, meaning the one that Morningstar recommended. And the after portfolio focused on first, getting an asset allocation that makes sense. Second, wanting to dramatically reduce the number of holdings. And finally, the right types of assets within each of her accounts.
I agree with you, Doug, that we have a lot of missing information when we look at this article. And, you know, and then we also realize that, wow, she has got a lot of stuff in a lot of pockets here.
Mm-hmm.
And
so your question is, what would I have done?
So what is your opinion? on this whole scenario?
First opinion is I don't have enough to make an opinion. That's the bottom line is
we're lacking information.
You should never give advice just on the portfolio. Our financial planning recommendations, however, would have all been focused on actively managed funds. When I look at the after portfolio that Morningstar gave versus the before, there's a huge emphasis on index funds. There are two managed funds. Most of them are index funds and bond funds. No. I would have no index funds.
So our philosophy is stay away from index funds.
That's right, Linda.
Stay away from ETFs.
That's right.
Even if they're cheap.
And the reason is, what's the reason, Deborah?
It's the opposite of actively managed. So if something is just passive, then it's going to ride up when everything goes up, and it's going to ride down when everything goes down. But if you pick a manager, you're picking a person, and you're basing your choice on their track record.
That's right.
And if you have their track record, then you can reasonably expect that they will do the same in the future.
And if you don't like their track record,
you can leave that person and go to someone else with a different track record. But if you're just floating up, floating down.
That philosophy
down,
of floating and riding the market is something that we feel is not a recipe for anything.
Leaves you more exposed than you need to be.
Exactly. Very well said, Debs.
It is. And so, bottom line, I feel is that Morningstar uses a money manager's approach. We use a financial planning approach.
And I agree with you, Doug, because financial planning isn't just dealing with your investments.
That's right.
Financial planning deals with your whole world.
So take out a pen and paper. Write down our number. It's 919-872-7000. Hold on to that pen and paper, and maybe you'll get some ideas of things you should talk about.
I do believe we have a caller.
Wait, this is Doug Lewis, certified financial planner. How can I help you?
Doug, Linda, I enjoy your show very much.
Thank you very much.
I'd like, if you could, to explain to me the difference between no-load, front-end load, and back-end load funds.
It's sort of like saying, do I sell my house with or without the use of a real estate broker? Well, the bottom line shouldn't be do I sell it with or without the help of a real estate broker. It's where do I make the most money?
Right, right.
And so what the sales charge is, or what the load is, that is the charge that does not get into the hands of the mutual fund managers. It's what you pay someone to help you select the different funds. That's what the load is.
Okay.
The load is simply a commission.
Right.
It's a commission paid to either a broker or financial planner to help you determine which mutual fund is best for you. When you say a no-load fund, that's for the person who says, I don't need any help. I can get my own funds, and I don't need any help. Funds who promote themselves as no-load funds, they go directly to the public, and they say, you don't need the help of anybody else. You can go ahead and read our material, and we will tell you why you should invest with us. That's generally recognized for very sophisticated investors that are able to do so. The question then of, do you pay the load up front, as most funds do, or do you go into a fund that says, you don't have to pay any load, we'll pay the commission to the person for you, but if you ever surrender or withdraw all of your money from this fund and cash it out and take it and buy yourself a car or a house and consume it, then at that time, the load will be paid. That's called a back-end load.
Okay.
I personally don't think that anybody should ever go into a mutual fund thinking that they're going to one day consume it. You should be trying to invest your money to such a degree that it provides comfort for you and it supports you, but not that you just consume the whole thing at one time.
Right, right.
And that's like, you know, that's what I call killing your chickens, and then you have no chickens and eggs.
Right.
Much better to live off the eggs.
So I guess if I'm understanding it, then a front-end load, let's say you went in with $10,000, you'd pay whatever the commission is on the $10,000 on the way in.
Right, maybe $500.
And then as you liquidate it or as you extract pieces from it to do things or break it out of the retirement or whatever, then there would be no additional commissions charged.
Right.
where on a back end, let's say over the course of 10 years, it became $15,000, and I'm just pulling numbers out of the air.
Yeah, that'd be a pretty bad fund, by the way, but yeah.
Okay.
But let's say it became $30,000.
Okay, and then you'd be, you'd pay the commissions on the total value if you did take it all out at one time.
And actually, most of back-end load funds, they peter out over a six-year period. So if you waited 10 years, there is nothing left anyway to be subtracted.
What do you mean that there's nothing left? There's no more commission?
Right. A lot of the funds offer incentives that say, even if it's back-end loaded, if you're willing to, I mean, if you stay in the fund for a period of, let's say, 6 years,
okay,
then there's still, you never pay the load.
So if you were to get out in the first year, it'd be X percentage, and the fourth year, it'd be a lower percentage, and then
right.
Beyond six, it would basically be 0%.
Right. And then there's the question of, well, what if I don't want to liquidate my fund and consume the money, but maybe I don't like the way my fund is running, and I'd like to switch to another fund. Well, then if you're in the family of funds, you can move from one fund to the other and not pay any commission, any load. Most families of funds let you move from liquidate one fund and go to another fund that they offer, maybe a stock fund or a bond fund or a balanced fund and so forth, and not pay it then.
Our number in Raleigh is 919-872-7000. That's 919-USA-7000.
Okay.
Doug, in relation to Wade's call, what are the expense ratios that one usually experiences if they get into
mutual funds? You see, that's a much more crucial factor, and that's something that not many people focus on. The load, whether it's front or rear, is a one-time sales charge that goes to the broker or the planner. However, what about the internal charges of running the fund? Most no-load funds have higher expense ratios,
okay.
But still the question is, well, what does the expense ratio, what is it composed of? And it's very interesting. The expense ratio has three categories. The three categories of what composes an expense ratio in a mutual fund are, first of all, the management fees. And that's how much the mutual fund manager is paid in his salary, how much it costs for the rent and all the support of the what's called the mutual fund advisory company. The management fees are one part of the expense ratio. And then there's a second part, which is called the 12B1 fee. And that's usually as much as 0.25% for marketing the product. And then there's a third type called other expenses, which are audit expenses, legal expenses, shareholder transfer, agent expenses, custodial expenses. Those are the other expenses. Now, those three categories, management fees, 12B1s, and other expenses, are the three categories broken out in every mutual fund prospectus. And typically, the industry average is about 1.5% per year.
For this total of the three?
Yes.
Okay.
There's a major expense that is not included in the expense ratios and is not a load, but no one ever knows about it, but it impacts drastically how much your fund makes in money. And those are the trading costs. In other words, the mutual fund manager, when he buys and sells stocks in your portfolio for you, he calls a brokerage firm.
Right.
And so there are commissions every time he buys and every time he sells. Well, these trading costs can be another 2% added on to a portfolio if the portfolio is what they call turned over a year's period of time.
Right.
If your mutual fund manager has a philosophy of buying stocks and holding them for the long term, then his trading costs are going to be less than a manager who has a 200% turnover ratio,
right,
which means he turns the entire portfolio over for the entire year.
Right.
So if you have an average cost ratio, let's say as the industry has, of maybe 1.5%, and you've got another trading cost, that's another 2%. You can have as much as 3.5% taken out of your fund every single year. And these are the things that you need to get into in the selecting of the fund. The load is a minor issue.
You see,
that's the help of the advisor.
Right.
But those are the factors that need to be looked at in terms of how your money is going to grow over time.
Okay, well, great. I certainly enjoy your show.
And if you have further questions, call the office in Raleigh at 919-872-7000. That's 919-USA-7000.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much for calling, Wade.
Well, Doug, that was a very interesting call from Wade about load funds versus no load funds. And then there's another discussion that needs to be had here about fees and charges. When a some advisors will charge a one-time sales charge when an investment purchase is transacted.
Okay.
But then there are others that are, and mainly fee-only advisors or money managers, who take your money and they advise you as to where they think you should position those dollars.
Well, yeah, let's get the language clear. You're exactly right, Linda. That's a whole subject matter that is being perpetrated upon the public and confuses the public. And I am very sensitive to this issue. They call themselves fee-only financial planners. I'm a fee-only financial planner, and we only do no-load funds. Well, what you're talking about are people that charge a fee to you every year.
Every year.
Of course. But they say you're going to be in no-load funds. Well, that's exactly true. There is no load, but there is this fee that you're paying. And the fee is, as you say, usually 1%. One of the major brokerage firms just announced that they are going up to 1.5% for accounts under half million, I think. So between 1% a year. So on a, you know, on a,
let's say you had $1 million.
You're talking about $10,000 a year to be in this kind of account, and you're getting no load funds. Well, do the math, and you're paying a lot more.
A lot of money every year.
Yeah. So the question really isn't load versus no load. It's what are the fees you're being charged, and for what services? Is it just for money management, putting you in mutual funds, or is it total financial planning, and how much is it costing you?
And you may only know of money management, and that might be as much as you have learned that you can buy advice on. And really, there's a whole world of financial topics that are pertinent to you, important to you, that affect your life, that you want to pay someone for advice on. And that's the comprehensive financial planner.
That's right. That's, yeah. I like the way you put it, Deborah, that it really depends on what you want. Do you want a financial planner that will give you advice in a comprehensive fashion in all sorts of areas other than just the world of mutual funds?
If you need help, call me, Deborah Lewis, 919-872-7000. 919-872-7000.
Another big area that you can find yourself needing a lot of advice on is estate planning. And when we're talking about estate planning, there are some things that are out there that we may not know a lot about, but they are called living wills.
Living wills are very much a part of what we do in our firm at Lewis Financial Management for our clients. We make sure that on the estate planning side, that you have an advanced directive, which is a set of instructions that you give, which outlines your health decisions in the event that you're unable to make those choices yourself. And one of those is the living will. The living will has nothing to do with what you think of when you think of a will. A will is where my assets are going to go when I die.
Right. A will would take effect at your death, you know, after I'm dead.
That's right. The living will can be very specific with regard to your medical treatments. And there are some specific medical treatments that you can consider and put into your living will, such as pain relief. How is it going to be managed if I become unable, if I become disabled, incapacitated in the hospital? What about pain relief? How's it going to be managed?
So let's look at a situation. You're driving down the road and all of a sudden you're in a bicycle accident, and you didn't plan on this happening. It was a sunny day and you had a bicycle accident. All of a sudden you can't walk, you can't go to work, you cannot even feed yourself. So who's going to take care of you
if you
you're
have
in
not,
the hospital?
That's right, Linda, because if you have not had a medical directive created ahead of time, then the hospital will decide how much pain relief you are going to receive and how it's going to be managed, what antibiotics are treatments for infections, what about artificial feeding? All of these things you can put in your own living will, your own healthcare power of attorney on your own? And what about cardiopulmonary resuscitation? Or what about ventilators, breathing machines? All of these things, we make sure that in our office, the client has already covered all these bases, as you said, Deborah, as part of total financial planning.
So when you leave instructions in a living will, you're basically taking the taking the initiative to go ahead and write down, well, if something were to happen to me, I'd like this person to speak for me.
That's right.
And I'd like for them to speak on my behalf with these things in mind.
That's right. We used to call that the healthcare power of attorney, that I am leaving power of attorney to my wife or to my daughter or to my this person who will have the right to override what the doctor says. This person will make the decisions about my health and my body as if I were
able to speak,
able to speak for myself and everything. Yeah. Now that healthcare power of attorney is very often part of the living will.
This is Deborah Lewis. Our number at the office is 919-872-7000. 919-872-7000.
You know, there are various stages of life. And, you know, as we get older, our needs change. And as a caregiver, there are health decisions that have to be made with the loved one for whom you may be providing care. And it's a very sensitive subject. So if you have not created a living will for yourself, make sure that you put that on the checklist of one of the things that you need to address, as well as healthcare power of attorneys, your will. If you have a will and you need it updated, put that on the checklist. And because your estate has grown and your assets have grown, you may need to consider a revocable living trust. Right, Doug?
That's right. All of that should be what's going to happen this year.
Awesome. Okay.
And if you are, like a lot of people in the United States, getting married maybe late in life or a second time, there is often a consideration of whether or not estate plans and prenups should be a part of that consideration before you tie the knot.
You know, Deborah, I'm glad you brought that subject up because as recent as last year, we had two cases like this. Prenuptial agreements aren't just about protecting assets in case of divorce. Increasingly, these contracts are being used as an estate planning tool by men and women. And so these prenuptials are particularly popular because of shifts in the demography, the demographics of marriages later, second marriages, and so forth. Most people are remarrying later, and baby boomers are now starting to take estate planning more seriously. So you can use these prenuptial agreements on this second marriage as an estate planning tool. What happens when I die? What I came into this marriage with either does or does not go to my second wife. Maybe it goes to my children. We can put into this prenuptial, which of course we did last year for clients. We can put into it the matter of the home. Now we're
right, a first home like the one that you're sharing and living in as your primary residence, or even a second home. A prenup can protect those assets from becoming mixed in with assets and property accumulated during the marriage that would be divvied up as part of someone's estate after death.
And, you know, Deborah, this is a real flashpoint right now. Vacation homes between surviving spouses and stepchildren. We can come up with a lot of different ways to make it exactly what you want by discussing it in the office as part of the total financial planning. We can do what's called qualified personal residence trusts. Those are called QPERTs. We can go ahead and have lifetime benefits to live in the home for the second spouse after the first one has passed away, but then maybe it passes to the children. It just needs to be part of the whole financial planning process, not just which mutual funds do I own.
You're listening to Money Matters with the Lewises on News Radio 680 WPTF.
If you hear something tonight that sounds like your situation,
Call us. Set up an appointment. We can help you. 919-872-7000. 919-872-7000.
Sometimes when the situation is dire or sad or you're facing a serious illness, this is really when some people are not paying attention, who had not been paying attention, really sit up straight and start getting concerned about what to do, you know, in their own financial planning.
You know, Deborah, this is another area of financial planning which many people totally ignore. We call it pre-mortem planning.
Yes.
Let's say that you have been diagnosed with a terminal illness. Well, in many cases, that's when people let their finances fall to the wayside. Nevertheless, coming up with a financial plan right at that time may be very crucial. I can think of a number of situations which we have had through the years, even last year. There can be bedside planning. You may want to go ahead and change the ownership. You've been diagnosed with a terminal illness. To change the ownership of a piece of property, for example, that your wife and you own together, to move it into your name so that the step up in basis will occur at the time.
At your death.
At your death, and then it goes back to her. It can then be sold tax-free. What about the investment portfolio? To redesign it in such a way that it meets your needs over the remaining months or a period of time. But all of these things need to be talked about, not need to be ignored. And I think,
and if there's enough time, I know, you know, people can get very creative. They can say, well, I have a life insurance policy that I no longer need or would like to use better, to where I can either spend the last days better or better leave.
That's right. You know, access the cash value.
Yes.
Access the cash value.
There's a lot of creativity.
There is creativity in pre-mortem planning, and it needs to be brought to the whole world of the client.
And make sure beneficiaries are named correctly on your financial accounts.
Oh, that's important. That's important, Linda. There's so many things that are part of total financial planning that really needs to be out there.
Thank you for joining us for another edition of Money Matters with the Lewises. Doug, Linda, and Deborah. You can listen to our podcast online at WPTF.com. Call us to set your appointment this week. 919-872-7000. That's 919-USA-7000.
You've been listening to Money Matters with Doug, Linda, and Deborah Lewis. Money Matters provides you with a personal financial hotline on any subject where money really matters. For more information, you can call Doug, Linda, or Deborah in Raleigh at 919-872-7000. That's USA 7000. Listen again next Saturday and Sunday at 5 p.m. for Money Matters with the Lewises on 680 WPTF.